Well, Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join me today here.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
You bet. And thank you, too. I've never thanked you in person for this, but you wrote some stuff that I quoted in a book I wrote a long time ago about...
I remember, yes. And you sent me a copy of the book.
The flu and vitamin C.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you very much for
You're
doing
welcome.
That. Appreciate it.
Thanks for using it.
Yeah. It's great. I mean, you've done a lot of great research, a lot of really quotable quotes that I've seen of yours on the internet. But how did you initially get interested in the area of vaccines?
By default, pretty much. I think that I was actually forced into it from a conscientious perspective and from what was happening around me. I really didn't think about vaccines very much throughout my career because I don't know if you know this, but medical doctors really aren't taught anything about what's in vaccines or the contents or the problems that can happen after vaccination. We're basically given a sheet of paper during a pediatric rotation and told this is the schedule and to keep up with it. And so the thinking there is, oh, I just got to make sure that everybody's got the ones that they need and which ones they need and not really critically thinking about it at all. And then I entered, you know, adult internal medicine, and then I specialized in nephrology. And so the vaccines there were basically part of a protocol when somebody first came into the dialysis unit. They would get hepatitis B series, and they would get influenza shots every year. And so it was just part of a protocol, which I just signed off on. So it really wasn't in my thinking at all.
Okay.
And so what happened in 2009, if you remember, there was the swine flu vaccine and there was the seasonal influenza vaccine. And so a lot of people got two shots that year. And my guess is that that's why more things happened, at least in my sphere. And so the first event was a fellow that was brought in out from the outside after having had normal kidney function. And he was on dialysis and told me that he was fine until he had that shot. And I said, what shot? And he said, that vaccine. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. So I looked into it some more, and I was like, sure enough, it sure seems logical and likely because your kidney function was normal before. And so this happened again and again, so three times. And I thought, wow, my administration's really going to want to know about this. So I was really kind of, you know, submit the next time I saw the chief of medicine in the hallway, I made sure I told him, and he just kind of stiffened up and stood back, and it was like, it's not from the vaccine. And I thought, why would you say that? You know, you never say that about an ACE inhibitor or a cholesterol drug or an antibiotic that's shutting down the kidneys. Why all of a sudden is it impossible for a vaccine to do this? And so my claims were denied, and I thought, well, that's all right. I'm just going to carry on, whatever. And so I decided to start asking the question of my inpatients and my outpatients, when was your last vaccine? And sure enough, I started to notice a correlation between either new onset kidney dysfunction or failure or worsening of old very rapidly. So at that point, I started to keep notes and start remembering names and events. And I kept a list of how many times this happened. And I went again to the administration. I said, look, there's even more evidence. Look, this one guy had this level of kidney function, which was normal when he came into the hospital. You gave him a flu shot within 24 hours, and look, now his kidney function went down within 24 hours, and the internists are chasing their tails trying to find a cause. It's the vaccine. And then, again, I was told they would discuss my concerns in a meeting that I wasn't invited to, and then they came back and told me that I was confusing the nursing staff by discontinuing vaccines and that it is a quality measure that was going to become universal in 2010 and I should back out of it. So for me at that point, the real problem was that they were vaccinating my sick inpatients the day they were admitted. And I, you know, because I thought, well, okay, I need to negotiate. So I said, can we just wait until they're discharged, the day of discharge? Why not put it on the discharge summary, vaccinate before they go home? That way I can figure out what's wrong with them. We can watch them get better without the, you know, interference of a vaccine. And I was told, no, they couldn't do that either. So at that point, I really started researching because what people kept saying to me is, what about smallpox and what about polio? And I didn't know anything about smallpox and polio beyond what any person outside would know. And so that's where really where my research began. And because I had to answer a lot of my own questions because I didn't really have any doubts in vaccines before that. I didn't know why we didn't see kids with one shorter leg or adults with one shorter leg anymore. I thought, well, polio must have gone away. That vaccine must have been successful. So it was after I started researching that I realized why we don't see children like that and why we don't see more adults becoming disabled in that same way.
Well, we'll get to that because I want to understand why. But a couple of things that you said were interesting in light of the fact that we just got through with an interview with another medical doctor, and he shared his same story of going through medical school and really learning nothing about vaccines other than here they are, they're safe and effective, here's the schedule, give them. And so it's, to me, that's just so bizarre that you don't get any kind of an education on vaccines except give them. That just doesn't seem like medicine.
I know. And I used to think it was just me because I was an adult internist. But when you look at people like Dr. Larry Pilevsky and Dr. Tony Bark, who actually specialized in pediatrics, and you hear the same thing from them, then you realize that medical schools are not providing this information, and there's no incentive to go. And look, you know, there's not a lot of time during residency. So unless something's really a problem, you're not going to go, you know, trying to disprove a well-proven theory or practice. So nobody does it.
So what did you learn about the smallpox and the polio vaccines when you began to look into them? And why don't we see people, you know, you mentioned an adult with one leg shorter than the other. What has happened? Were those diseases eradicated because of the vaccines? Because that's the common belief.
Yes,
it
is a common belief. And I think that, you know, smallpox is a little more difficult to touch and intellectually in that way because it's been out of our visual field for so long. We stopped vaccinating for it. But if you look back at the history, what was really interesting to me and what's in our book, Roman Bistrionic and I wrote a book called Dissolving Illusions, where we cover smallpox in depth and polio in depth, mostly at a time when we were trying to answer our own questions. And so we went through lots of historical documents and vital statistics and found information that was completely counter to the sound bites that we often hear about, you know, that Edward Jenner was the father of vaccinology and, you know, saved the world from smallpox, and that Jonas Salk and Sabin were the other heroes who saved us from polio. And so to tell you, just to summarize that now in just a short time is impossible. And in fact, the 500-page book is really the cliff notes of what happened. But in brief, you know, smallpox was a big problem. You know, people were dying, you know, it would accumulate in the throat, these pox, and people would suffocate and they couldn't swallow. It was painful. There was scarring, was horrible. But like any disease, you have to look at what the conditions of the environment was like, which tells you how well people's immune systems were able to work. And that's really the key. And then on top of that, it's how the disease was treated. So people had been trying to fight smallpox for a long time, you know, for, you know, thousands of years. They had been trying to come up with, you know, in ancient Hindu times, they were trying to take scabs of, you know, of smallpox victims and use those for vaccines. And each time what happened was that just epidemics were started when this happened. So using
They started epidemics.
Yes, because using smallpox as a vaccine, they didn't know how to attenuate, which means to make the vaccine weaker, the virus weaker. And so they were basically just giving a controlled case of smallpox. And it didn't go well because, of course, it spread to any contacts, and there was an incubation period where people wouldn't know they were infected. So that plan failed several times in different parts of the world. And then there was this rumor going around England in the late 1700s that if you were infected by cowpox, which was a pox disease that cows got on their udders, that if you were infected by that you became immune to smallpox. So then the idea that taking pus from either the nipple of the cow directly or indirectly from a milkmaid's hand, which is how Jenner did his first vaccine, and then placing a cut in somebody's arm or leg and inoculating them directly with pus was going to make them immune to smallpox. It's a completely uncontrolled experiment that went on countrywide. Where people weren't followed out for long term. There was no, you know, vaccinated and controlled, and they couldn't really tell who had had smallpox before because, of course, some of those people had already suffered smallpox that were used in his groups. And the doctors of the time were, you know, saying that this is absurd, that we're still seeing plenty of smallpox in people who have been cowpox vaccinated, and that this vaccine is far from safe, that people were having major issues from it. Deaths were happening. In some cases, in the years that the vaccine was being used, the hospitalization rates for, and death rates for smallpox were higher than the years before the vaccine was even invented. So there were major problems. And so what's really interesting was to listen to the doctors of the time, some of them who bought into the vaccine theory hook, line, and sinker because they wanted a cure for this. They wanted a preventative for this. And then when they saw what actually happened, they had to, if they had any soul left and any conscience, then they had to come out saying, you know, this is an abomination and it needs to stop. So there was that. And then there was, you know, this episode in a city called Leicester in England at the time where, you know, they had a 95% infant vaccination rate and had some of the worst epidemics in history in that city. And so people were outraged because mandatory vaccination had been instituted. People were being arrested and, you know, their belongings confiscated. Horrible. And we went through a lot of these stories in the book. And so people had had enough. And so they demonstrated. And so there was this great demonstration, which is one of our chapters. And there was a big rally with over 80,000 people that showed up. I mean, these people were angry. Their kids were getting really messed up from this vaccine, and it wasn't working. So it's one thing to take the risk of getting a vaccine if it's working. But in this case, it was lose-lose for them. So they decided they were going to stop vaccinating. And instead, whenever somebody had smallpox, they had people that were already immune tend to the person, and they sanitized everything in their midst and kept them isolated. And that turned out to be actually the best way to deal with smallpox in communities. And so, you know, predictions of doom and gloom that there was going to be a wildfire of smallpox set upon the planet as a result of this lunatics who wanted to stop vaccinating were, you know, dictated from on high. And of course, that didn't happen. And we give you the exact numbers in Dissolving Illusions of how the death rates plummeted and how the outbreaks actually went down significantly. And Leicester, compared to the surrounding towns that continued to vaccinate heavily, had the lowest death rates. Mm. And in lots of cases, the actual outbreak rates as well. And then this was repeated again in Yugoslavia in the 1970s, and we wrote about that, that in a different way where, you know, very highly, highly vaccinated population, a guy gets vaccinated and then he goes on a pilgrimage to the Middle East. He comes back even though he was vaccinated. There's plenty of time for it to take and everything. And he spreads smallpox all over Yugoslavia. Mm. And you know, even the CDC and the World Health Organization talked about how, you know, this was a very highly vaccinated population, how the vaccines just didn't take in some cases, they didn't last very long. And so, you know, to save face, they went and vaccinated millions of people again, just so that they could give credit to the vaccine, where in effect what really, you know, made that outbreak smolder out was isolation and sanitation, just like what happened in Leicester. So there's just lots of interesting stories about how the vaccine was used, where it came from, all the different animals that, you know, this to me is one of the most interesting things is that, you know, a lot of people think that even today, this Dryvax vaccine that we use, or in certain cases, the military is given. And I was actually offered it so that because the hospital needed some physicians to be immune to treat the people who developed smallpox from their vaccines. I declined that. So this vaccine people think is cowpox, but it's not. It's actually a virus that is some sort of a human and multi-animal hybrid that was never on the earth until they started vaccinating. So it was anyone's best guess what was in a vaccine in the first, you know, 150 years that it was used. Even up to the 1950s and 60s, doctors were writing about how it's a combination of mule pox, rabbit pox, horse pox, cow pox, and human. And depending on where the vaccines were made, it could vary in its consistency, and it was anything but pure.
Mm. Wow.
So that's... when you understand that, you kind of think, well, how could it have possibly eradicated anything?
Yeah. Well, you know, I did get a chance to skim through Dissolving Illusions, and there's a lot of statistics in there. There's a lot of, so I look forward to going back into there to get some of the statistics that we can use while you're talking about this in the interview. But that's that's fantastic. What Dissolving Illusions, I love the name. So what are some of the illusions we need to dissolve? What are the illusions?
Well, you know, most of the illusions that doctors have that are handed down year after year, decade after decade, that, you know, vaccines were the single most effective preventive in medical history. And there are other allusions that, you know, people were dying in droves until the healthcare system was developed and antibiotics and interventions in that way came in, you know, to be used regularly. And that the lifespan, this is the big one, is that our lifespans, you know, now what's the average lifespan, 75 to 80, something like that. You know, there were people living well into their 90s, hundreds of years ago. And in general, they were people who had access to, you know, good food, if, you know, people who had clean water and a decent lifestyle. And so those people have done fairly well throughout history. And the people who were really dying and having the most trouble were women during childbirth, because doctors didn't learn to wash their hands until not that long ago. And so, you know, puerperal fever and childbirth death was had a major impact, not only on infant mortality at the time, maternal mortality, but then on how well the other kids in the family did in a time where, you know, money was short. People were, you know, gathering in cities. They were basically being taken out of the countryside because of the land enclosure acts, and being brought into cities, at least in England. And so the infrastructure wasn't there for them. So the big message in Dissolving Illusions is that, you know, humanity can move in either direction, either towards health or away from health, depending on what's going on in society, what the stress levels of people, especially children, are, amount of sleep that they get, the food that they get, working conditions. And conditions were beyond what we can actually imagine today, unless maybe you visited some of the worst parts of India or some really poor countries that are, you know, just basically living in filth. That's what was going on back then. And so, of course, any disease that came along, measles deaths were rampant. You know, you didn't want to catch a disease back then because there was a good chance that you would die from it. So then the vaccines came along and were given, and the medical system came along and were given the credit for the death rates going down and for the lifespan increasing. But we've shown you with statistics that nobody argues with. See, even people who don't like us don't argue with the vital statistics, because all we did was graph them out. And so what you can do is graph them out and see the death rate was going down, down, down. And in the case of measles and whooping cough, it was basically at baseline. It was basically close to zero. And then the vaccine comes in. Yeah. You know, and so the next argument was, well, it's just death. You know, we still had lots of disease going on. And it's kind of funny because, you know, if the pharmaceutical industry had invented something that made a greater than 99% mortality rate go down, it would be a sacrament, right? Yeah. And when the doctor wants to scare parents into vaccinating today, what do they say? Your baby could die. Mm-hmm. So death is really important, and death has always been the primary measure of health in a society, has been the death rate, both the infant mortality and the longevity rate. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that's I interviewed a couple weeks ago in Austin Neil Miller, mm-hmm. who wrote a book on, I can't remember, it's critical vaccine studies.
It's a great book, resource.
Yeah, he and Goldman, they showed that the U.S. highest vaccination rate, highest infant mortality.
That's right.
So that is how we would measure it. Mm-hmm. So what you're saying then, Dr. Suzanne, is that most of these communicable diseases that we are led to believe were eradicated because of the vaccines, were actually, the death rate had already bottomed out because of the fact, what led to the eradication of these diseases before the vaccines?
Well, let's just first talk about eradication, because really the only disease that is claimed to have been eradicated by a vaccine worldwide is smallpox. Okay. But I challenge anybody to go onto Google Images and put in the term monkeypox. And what you will come up with are photographs of children in Africa who have a pox disease that would have been considered identical to smallpox. And that even the authors of this, of several of the articles and doctors that they interviewed say, well, in the old days, this would have been considered smallpox, but because today we can distinguish genetically the viruses, and in some cases, even looking under the microscope, we can tell what is a smallpox virus versus what is a monkeypox, et cetera, et cetera. So there have been lots of different kinds of pox viruses, obviously. But back in the days when, you know, food was scarce, healthy food was scarce, and people were drinking sewage as their water, you know, these kids that are surviving in Africa would have died. And so in my opinion, you know, pox diseases did go down and they got milder before the smallpox became milder before it was eradicated. And so that's the only disease that is claimed to have been eradicated. And I think there's actually some question about that. Then if we go to polio, that's only claimed to be eradicated in our hemisphere here. And of course, they're still vaccinating for it in other parts of the world, especially very heavily vaccinating in India, and just recently reintroduced an oral polio vaccine in Israel, which really wasn't needed at all. And so that's going to cause a whole other set of problems because you're introducing new vaccine viruses that can revert to virulence, and this is all very well known. So most people there are having to take the injected vaccine and the oral vaccine. So that virus isn't eradicated.
Well, one of the things that I've read over the last several years is that we're actually seeing outbreaks of polio in the areas that they're vaccinating, but they're not calling it polio.
Right. And so that actually is the case in America as well, in that, you know, poliomyelitis is a description of what happens in physiologically in the body, where the anterior horn of the spinal cord is altered, and then the nerves and the muscles have downstream effects. And they can vary in intensity and duration. And it also can affect the brainstem. And those are the worst kinds of poliomyelitis. Those are the ones where the breathing centers are shut down and the iron lung was needed at the time. And people, you could die from that one. So I also want to remind people that even during the worst outbreaks of polio, 95%, so if we had 100 people and we infected all of them with polio, which is a, you know, it's a virus that's swallowed, that 95% of them wouldn't even know that they had an infection. There would be no symptoms whatsoever, and there would be immunity. And then 4% would maybe have some malaise, maybe some muscle ache, some diarrhea, and then recover. And then 1% would have paralysis of one or two muscle groups that would last for 24 hours, and that 5 to 10% of those could have long-term paralysis. So the poliomyelitis was actually a very low-incidence disease.
So basically 5 to 10% of the 1%, so you're talking about 5 to 10 out of 1,000 would
yes.
have some kind of a long-term effect.
Right. 5 to 10% of that 1,000 would have some sort of paralysis that could last longer than 24 hours. But as you, I think you just asked me if they changed the definition of polio. Yeah. And so, yes, the answer is yes. And so what happened after that time, and poliomyelitis was declining in its incidence before the vaccine, but only slightly. But the death rate had gone down significantly as well before the vaccine. So poliomyelitis being a description of a physiology doesn't actually tell you what the cause is. So that's really key to understanding what polio was and why we say it's eradicated in the United States. Even though we have cases of poliomyelitis today, we don't necessarily have poliovirus-induced cases of poliomyelitis, because the fact is that even back in the 1940s and 1950s, that any one of a number of infections could have caused poliomyelitis. And that was actually determined later, after the vaccine was released, when outbreaks would occur, and the authorities wanted to distinguish what was actually poliovirus from what wasn't. And what they found was that roughly a little more than one quarter was poliovirus, and the rest were other viruses, Coxsackie virus, et cetera, that can cause paralysis. And then they found no virus at all in a lot of people. So, you know, DDT and arsenic are known causes of anterior horn spinal cord disease that can mimic poliomyelitis from start to finish, even from the sore throat, the feeling of swelling in the throat, the fevers, the aches and pains, to a T. And we also go through the references in the book to prove that. So there were several steps that were taken to change how the public viewed polio, in order to make the vaccine appear to be far more effective than it was. And again, there were very credible doctors at the time saying, hey, wait a minute. And they were very upset about it too. And they said, you're not playing fair. You know, you've changed how you're counting polio. And the fact of the matter is that the first vaccines that were released had live virus in them and were actually causing more paralysis than they were preventing. And that's, again, very well demonstrated in graphics from the, I believe it was 1954 to 1958. There's a graph in the book that shows you the amounts of poliomyelitis or paralysis that was occurring, and it was occurring largely in vaccinated populations. And the only reason that vaccine didn't cause more problems than it did was because the majority of the population was already immune to polio. So they could be injected with a live vaccine and not have an effect from it. But it would have been a disaster had it been what we call a virgin population who had never been exposed to it. It would have been an absolute medical disaster. Mm. I mean, the Qatar incident was a medical disaster where there was a very highly packed vaccine with live virus given to the public. And so Qatar basically took the rap for that problem and had to close their doors. But the truth was that Wyeth was also releasing similar vaccine.
So the Qatar incident, was that polio?
Yes. That was where the inactivation wasn't complete in those live viral particles were still in the vaccines that were being administered. So you basically, instead of swallowing your live virus, you were directly injected with it. So needless to say, the chances of that going bad were quite high.
And so in the Qatar incident is a situation where the people were actually, there was an outbreak of polio caused by the vaccine?
Yes. And okay. Actually, interestingly enough, Paul Offit wrote a very good book about the Qatar incident. It's very accurate and it's very interesting.
That is interesting that Paul Offit wrote, okay. Has he retracted it yet?
No, because it's kind of, the reason for it was, we have this great vaccine that's done a great thing, and sometimes we have stumbling blocks in the beginning, and this is the story. And it's very well told and very, very good read.
I've read that, I think it was Salk, testified before Congress that, his polio vaccine had caused every case of polio over the last couple of decades. There's something in the late 70s, I know he went before Congress. Are you familiar with that at all? Salk?
Well, what I know is that Salk trashed Sobin's vaccine and Sobin trashed Salk's vaccine, okay. And I know that's true. And I remember that Salk said that during the era of the Sobin vaccine, which was the live attenuated swallowed vaccine, that all of the cases in America of polio were caused by that vaccine.
Okay, that's what I was thinking of. Yeah. Okay, so he was trashing the other guy's polio vaccine. Okay, got it. So then is it possible then that polio really never went away? It just, they changed the name or they changed the criteria for diagnosing polio so that it looked like it went away.
Well, they did a couple of things. So in the beginning, it was highly inflated. So for instance, in order to get subsidized, these cases that were in the hospitals and being treated, anyone could make the diagnosis of polio before the vaccine. So all it took was somebody to do two exams 24 hours apart and finding one or more muscle groups that had paralysis. And so that would be called polio. There was no, blood or stool testing or anything like that. And then after the vaccine was released, not just anybody could confirm a case of polio. And there had to be two examinations done 60 days apart that showed one or more muscle groups that remained paralyzed for 60 days. Now, mind you, the majority of paralytic polio, even back in 1954, would resolve within 60 days. So just by changing that diagnostic criteria, they eliminated a huge amount of polio. There were cases that were called aseptic meningitis. So this was polio, but not necessarily paralysis. Those were all taken off the books as being called polio. Mm. They increased the number of cases that needed to occur in order to be called an epidemic. So these were some of the moves that were made at the time, and then they started testing for the actual virus. So that eliminated. So whether or not a vaccine ever came out, polio would have decreased probably down by 3/4, whether just because of the change in the criteria. Mm.
So it'd be just an analogy would be that you're in a room with 10 people and three of them weigh over 200 pounds and they're considered obese because somebody that's over 200 pounds is obese. And now they change the definition of obesity to be over 300 pounds. And now you have no obese people in the room.
That's exactly
right.
It's
exactly the same population. They just changed the definition.
That's right.
Okay.
And
it's kind of sneaky, isn't it?
And it was highly celebrated, this victory over polio. The future was going to have no more of these, children with, contracted limbs and problems like that. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I guess to the child that's paralyzed, they don't really care the parents don't really care if there's a polio virus that they can find or not. Their kid's paralyzed, right? So whether it's paralytic polio or non-polio paralysis, what difference does that make? The kid's paralyzed, right?
That's exactly
right. So it's a game of redefining the term, isn't it?
Absolutely, because we still have just as much paralysis, if not more, today than we did back then. We just treat it differently, so the outcome looks different, which is why we don't see the paralytic limbs. We don't have iron lungs anymore. We have ventilators. And so that's really, transverse myelitis is a disease where we have hundreds of cases every year in this country. That would have been considered a horrific epidemic, back in the 1950s, would have been called polio. And here it's called transverse myelitis, and these children are on ventilators, and they have major problems. So there's a very long, and we listed this in Dissolving Illusions, of diseases of today that would have been called polio of yesterday, like Lyme disease, and that's different kinds of meningitis, aseptic meningitis. Even the other thing that happened is that if somebody developed polio within 30 days, poliomyelitis within 30 days of having their vaccine, they weren't counted as a case of polio either. So that eliminated vaccine failures and cases that were caused by the vaccine. So there was all kinds of clever manipulation that went on in order to inflate the efficacy of that vaccine.
What's the logic for removing someone from the sample that gets polio after the vaccine?
Well, because then the vaccine didn't cause it. And that was actually a problem back then, is that the vaccines, because they didn't know how to really kill all of the virus in the vaccine, that vaccine-induced paralysis was happening because of live polioviruses, but also because of something, what is the name of it? Provocation polio, where, there was a time where there were epidemics going on. Now, whether it was DDT or arsenic or actually poliovirus circulating, what we do know is that if you had a tonsillectomy when these epidemics were occurring, or if you had any injection whatsoever, that you were likely to have an injection in that, paralysis in that limb that was injected. And the theory was because you gave the virus access to a nerve through using that injection, and the same with removing the tonsils. And so tonsillectomies and vaccines and any kind of injections were highly discouraged during these epidemics because of this phenomenon of provocation polio. It's very well documented.
Interesting. What did Dr. Bernice Eddy discover about the link between the polio and cancer, the polio vaccine and cancer?
Well, this is a really fascinating story. Dr. Bernice Eddy worked at the NIH, and in the 1950s, right around the year, she was given the job of looking for safety of the vaccine. And what she noticed when she was injecting hamsters with it is that they were developing tumors. That was one of the problems. And then in monkeys, she was noticing that they were becoming paralyzed and dying. So she actually noticed two problems. But when it comes to the cancer aspect, that's different than the paralysis aspect, because she was one of the first to notice that there were live viruses in the vaccine that were still causing paralysis, but nobody listened to her. So she noticed these tumors were occurring at the injection site and also distally in the lungs and the kidneys after injection. And so she decided one day to do an experiment where she just didn't even use polio virus at all. She just took the cell cultures from the rhesus monkey kidneys and skimmed off some of the liquid that was sitting on top and injected some animals with that, and she found that they developed tumors. And then she took some of the material from that tumor and injected it into other generations and found that each time 100% of these animals developed tumors. And it was really interesting to me because as a kidney specialist, as a nephrologist, to learn about this virus, SV40, I actually only learned about it after I had left my conventional job in 2011. And I thought, well, this is so interesting that I never knew about any of the amazing research that was done in 1962, where they actually knew that this virus, this simian virus 40, which was the 40th virus that was found in these cultures that came from monkeys, actually was able to transform normal cells into cancer cells. And that they found that this to be true in kidney cells in petri dishes. And they called it a transformative virus, in other words, a cancer-causing virus back then. And then, like, the lid came down. And after 1962, where Shine and Enders did these studies showing this, we don't hear about it anymore. And I talk a lot about this in a video that I did called Honesty Versus Policy, where I talk about Bernice Eddy, and I talk about these studies in particular, and I show the first page of them. And so not only was kidney cancer a problem from these polioma viruses, they're called polioma viruses because they cause multiple tumors, In nephrology, we really only cared about two other polyomaviruses, because when those can be sitting silently in you or me right now, but if we undergo immunosuppression for a kidney transplant, then it can become very problematic and shut the kidney down. And so you have to kind of lower the drugs so that the immune system can come back. So again, it's another case of healthy immune system. These things aren't a big deal. Not a healthy immune system, they can cause cancer or organ failure. But this simian virus 40 that Dr. Bernice Eddy discovered is also relevant today to kidney specialists, and most of them don't even know it, that they find this virus in particular diseases of the kidney at a much higher rate. So about 45% of people who have a disease called focal and segmental glomerulosclerosis, it's a mouthful even for me. Mm-hmm. It's a serious disease that most people end up on dialysis, and it's very common actually. 45% of them will have simian virus 40 in their kidneys, as opposed to you and I, maybe 0 to 10% of us will have it. And even people with other kidney diseases, about 10%. So it's actually been associated with some really serious protein losing kidney diseases that puts people on dialysis. But we don't hear about it today. And just like vaccines, it's not taught in medical school or to kidney specialists.
That's interesting. And you being a nephrologist, that's right up your alley, isn't it?
And that I had only discovered it after I left and was doing vaccine research is really interesting.
Yeah, did you ever wonder why you were never taught these kind of things in medical school? I mean, did you ever ponder that?
Well, afterwards I did. And I mean, I don't have to ponder it that much, because now, you know, I pretty much understand who you know, is backing what's being taught at medical schools, and that this information, I mean, if people were to, you know, really, it would be like embracing the fact that dental amalgams can cause problems. It's like, look, all these people would have to have their amalgams. Who's going to pay for it, for this to happen? Who's going to pay for all the problems that happen downstream? And if we were to notice all the people carrying simian virus 40, most of us are carrying simian virus 40 even today, because it's been passed down from generation to generation. So it was introduced into the human population in the 1950s from monkeys, and it's here to stay.
Yeah. Talk about vitamin C. We talked about that, or we've corresponded about that in the past regarding the flu. Mm-hmm. But then also, could vitamin C have any effect on polio?
Well, you know, vitamin C being an
And actually, I'm sorry, whooping cough too, pertussis. I think you discussed it. We exchanged emails about pertussis as well. So all of those together.
Yeah. Well, you know, today vitamin C is one of my primary tools as a medical doctor, and since I've discovered it, it's really been probably the best medication that I've ever used on myself or my patients. And I'm not the first to discover this. There have been many for decades before me, and one of the first to really embrace it and write about it and use it in all kinds of different situations was Dr. Fred Klenner. And a lot of people don't hear about Dr. Klenner because his writing is not something that circulates in conventional medical realms, because he was pretty forthright about calling the doctors of his time quacks. You know, he just turned that term right around on them and showed in no uncertain terms that what they were doing was incredibly backwards and harmful. When he was curing cases of paralytic polio, he was using antibiotics, he was using steroids, and he was also using very high doses of intravenous or intramuscular vitamin C. And he outlined, there's copious amounts of writing of his, and he outlines in great detail exactly what his protocols were and how well they worked case after case after case. In not just polio, but influenza. He used it during pregnancy in very high doses, all throughout pregnancy, before delivery. And he used it in all kinds of poisonings. Like he described snake bite poisonings and spider bite poisonings that it was very useful for as well. And, you know, he talked about the conventional medical community, that they would rather watch a patient, you know, die than realize that they're denying a cure that's at their fingertips.
So vitamin C. Are there any side effects to vitamin C?
Well, I just want to make a point here, because there's a lot of discussion within the vitamin C supporters of whether using the synthetic chemical form of sodium ascorbate versus using the whole complex vitamin C is better or worse. And so my answer is that when you have a serious paralytic disease or you've been poisoned, you need such high doses that you're not going to get that from, you know, from your leafy green vegetables or from fruit. Like, you need the drug dose. And while those cofactors that you get in the larger molecule are really important, you actually have some of them in your body already. And you need the drug dose in order to neutralize these toxins and get the neutrophils moving in the way that they need so that they don't explode and cause more inflammation. And that's really one of the major things that vitamin C does. Okay. So whenever I'm going to treat anyone with vitamin C, I'm very clear about the potential reactions that you can have from them. And the big one is that if you're one of the few people, and this happens more in males than females and mostly in the Mediterranean population, that is deficient in an enzyme called glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase.
Is there a shortcut for that?
G6PD.
Cool.
And that if you take massive amounts of vitamin C, that you could have your red blood cells breaking open, hemolysis. However, if you're bordering on scurvy and you still need vitamin C, your body will handle it just fine. Okay. But it's something that I want all of my patients to know about beforehand. So that's probably the biggest problem that can happen. But again, you don't see this. If this was common, even if it was rare and it happened enough, you'd see case reports in the medical literature. You just don't find them. You see more case reports from sulfa drugs that are used every day and from things like fava beans causing G6PD problem. So that's one. And then there's the big question, do kidney stones form more readily in people who are taking high doses of vitamin C? And I studied this in depth a couple of years ago. And my opinion after studying that and understanding how kidney stones are formed is that if you're somebody who tends to form kidney stones anyway, and you're very dehydrated, and you've taken large amounts of vitamin C, and also maybe are drinking a lot of fructose-containing beverages and eating an unhealthy diet, yeah, you might have a higher preponderance for developing a kidney stone than somebody who's more hydrated and doesn't have that problem. And then there's, the diarrhea. And I've been told that I'm going to kill babies by causing diarrhea, giving them bowel necrosis. Well, I can tell you that if somebody has whooping cough or, a serious inflammatory disease, they're very unlikely to develop diarrhea easily. Mostly they need very high doses in order to even get a bowel flush. And what you notice after that flush is that they improve. Mm-hmm. That because you're eliminating endotoxin, you're freeing up the liver to be able to do its job better. And it's very well known that vitamin C enhances liver function, enhances adrenal function, and it enhances neutrophil function, all things that you need to be able to mount an adequate immune response. So while people want to criticize oral vitamin C use, or I should say sodium ascorbate use, because it can cause diarrhea if you use high enough doses and you're not dosing frequently in smaller doses, but less frequently in bigger doses. Yes, it can cause diarrhea, but it doesn't last for days. It's one episode of diarrhea. I've never known anybody to become dehydrated after one episode of diarrhea. And I'm always very clear, stay well hydrated while you're taking your sodium ascorbate. So it's actually, I did a talk in Sweden to the Orthomolecular Society, where I went through just how incredibly safe, there's a lethal dose, LD50, that's measured in different drugs. And you go through the PDR and you can see that there's no drug in the entire PDR that's as safe as vitamin C. Mm.
So you successfully used it to treat whooping cough.
Well, okay. So using vitamin C in infants, children, and adults who have whooping cough doesn't make the cough go away. Okay. It doesn't treat it like, say, some antibiotic could maybe treat a staph infection. Mm. It basically, what it does is it energizes the immune system because, it gives the neutrophils the energy that it needs. And, there's something called apoptosis, which is what cells that need to die do. And so they basically involute so that they don't spill their caustic contents inside your body. If you don't have vitamin C, those neutrophils and macrophages that are just eating these, particles that are trying to infect you will just explode and cause even more inflammation. So vitamin C decreases inflammation in lots of ways. That's one. It's a direct antioxidant. So whooping cough is a toxin-mediated disease. You neutralize the toxin by putting electrons in there, and you notice a difference. It actually loosens up the secretions in the lung within 24 to 48 hours. The secretions become thinner and more watery. And it also, again, it frees up the liver to do its job. So, as a toxin neutralizer and an immune system enhancer, and it also gives tissues the strength. You know, you can't make collagen without adequate amounts of vitamin C. So it's not a miracle, and I'm very clear with parents before I get going, but so far there's been 100% success rate. No babies have died. I've treated babies as young as 2 weeks old. And it's no picnic. It's a nail-biting experience. But when the medical system has done everything they can do and the child is still extremely sick and the parents are looking for help, they often come to me. And sometimes they come to me before they go to the medical system because they're that confident in what they want. And you can read the testimonials. When I ask parents to write testimonials, I don't say to talk about me. I say, I want you to talk about you, what your fear level was, what you expected, what the vitamin C did, and how you feel now. And so that's really what the testimonials are intended to do, is to just show other parents, what vitamin C can do. It's not a miracle, but it makes the baby so that they're not turning blue anymore. They're not gasping for air. The coughs become manageable. Your nights become easier. They're not always easy. There's a week where, there's a lot of sleepless time during that 1 week.
Okay. In 2011, the Supreme Court, I think it was Buck versus Bell, determined that vaccines are unavoidably unsafe. But we are told vaccines are safe and effective. So how can those two be true? They're unavoidably unsafe, but they're safe.
Right. So if I was working for the other side, I would say to you, well, in 1 in 1 million cases, they are unavoidably unsafe. And we don't know who those people will be. But because we're trying to protect an entire society, we have to take that risk that once in a while, somebody's going to have a bad outcome after a vaccine. And then I would say, and as for them being safe and effective, that is true for the majority of the population because we've measured 24 hours, sometimes 4 hours after a vaccine, and the person doesn't die and they don't have anaphylactic shock, that means they're safe. And because we measure antibody levels, instead of measuring who gets sick and using a real saline placebo, they're effective. And that's how it's defended.
Got it. Now, what do you mean, instead of using a real saline placebo, what are used for placebos?
Well, that was really one of the real surprising elements to me when I started to research, because conventionally, I worked in a lab. I know what a placebo should be. It should be an inert substance that has no physiological effect. When it comes to vaccines, it's very rare to find the studies that are actually used for the FDA approval to use a saline placebo. Instead, what will be used is either the background substance of a vaccine, which might have aluminum in it, or polysorbate 80, or some amino acids, or even more commonly, another vaccine that has already been proven safe. So, for instance, if you want to test this year's flu shot, you will test it against last year's flu shot for its safety rather than testing it against a saline placebo. Or you'll test it against a hepatitis A vaccine, which is well documented to have been done. And the defense by the vaccine enthusiasts is that they didn't want to deprive the placebo arm of something that could be helping them, since they volunteered to be in the study and were helping them. Wanted to give them back something helpful.
That's unreal. I did not know that they used other vaccines in the placebo groups.
Yeah, a hepatitis A vaccine is one of the more infamous placebos being used in the influenza studies. When it comes to the Gardasil, the HPV vaccines, there were a very small amount of the original trials where they actually used saline, but the vast majority used either an aluminum-containing background substance or the rest of the chemicals that are in the vaccine.
Yeah, I think it was either Barbara or Dr. Larry that just mentioned the Gardasil vaccine, and it was aluminum or polysorbate 80 maybe.
Yeah, and there were some amino acids. I think lysine, maybe it was not lysine. I can't actually remember which amino acid it was.
Wow, I mean,
L-histidine, which is very similar to histamine. And there's some evidence and suspicion that some of the adverse reactions, the immune mediated or say allergic IgE responses could be related to that histidine.
That's just really, as much as I know about how dirty things are and how truth is covered up, that still shocks me that they actually use another vaccine or toxic adjuvants in the control group. That's like, that's dirty baseball, any way you cut it.
Well, you know, it does seem that way. And I'll tell you what shocks me even more is the abuse and attack that I have endured from the pro-vaccine. I'll call them the vaccine addicts, who basically tell me all the reasons why it's a perfectly ethical thing to do.
How can you justify that? How do they try to justify the control group getting a vaccine?
Well, they say that what they're using as the placebo has already been proven safe. And one of the reasons that sticks out in my mind is they say that if you give a saline placebo, that the person getting the injection won't have a pain in the arm, so they'll know that they were in the placebo arm. Whereas if you give them a vaccine or something that has an immune stimulant that can cause inflammation, like aluminum, then they won't know. And so the bias within the study will be better because the people who got the placebo won't know that it was a placebo.
That's such nonsense.
It is. I mean, it's just one of 1,000 bits of nonsense that I've encountered in the past 5 years.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's grasping at straws to try to support their position.
Well, it's very helpful for them because, you know, there are studies that use saline. One that I mention often was by Cowling in 2013. And what they did is, and this is to me exemplifies why saline is not used as a placebo. They did a really good study where they vaccinated something like 100 people with trivalent influenza vaccine and gave a saline placebo to another 100. And then they actually followed them over the winter. And any time there was any upper respiratory infection, they cultured them and figured out what it was. And what they found was that there really wasn't a huge difference in the influenza viral infections. But depending on which strain, it could have gone either way. But what was really stuck out in my mind is that there was a 4 to 5 times higher incidence of non-influenza viral infections in the vaccinated, and with some very nasty viruses that would have been called polio in the old days. Mm. So that's, you know, in my opinion, they know this, and they know that there would be a huge skew between the placebo and the vaccinated, both in safety and efficacy, if they did studies this way, and that's why it's not done.
Wow, that's fascinating. I'm gonna look up that. Was that in one of your books, the Cowling 2013 study?
I'll give you the study.
That'd be great if you could, because I'd like to see that.
Yep.
And that was flu vaccine?
Yep.
Okay. So flu vaccine safe and effective?
Personally, I wouldn't want to be in the same room as a flu vaccine. And, you know, a lot of people ask me, when would it be that I would accept a vaccine, either for myself or for someone I loved or a child? And the answer would be there would have to be a horrible epidemic going on where people were dying, where my risk of dying was high, and where there was not only a safe vaccine but an effective vaccine. And I've actually not encountered that situation in my lifetime. So when it comes to influenza, you know, I mean, I could rattle off study after study showing you just exactly why they don't do what they're supposed to do. What's really interesting to me is that whenever there is a new vaccine in the pipeline ready to be released, that's when these very pro-vaccine scientists will admit that there were problems with the vaccines that are being mass marketed today. And so, you know, for years we were told how safe and effective the influenza vaccine. Well, we know it's not effective. They just took the inhaled influenza shot off the market because it was only 3% effective last year.
I read that.
That's pretty bad.
That.
And it wasn't that great beforehand. And it was spreading, influenza. Just read the package insert. But when it comes to the injected vaccine, if you are naive to a certain strain of that virus, and that virus is the one that you encounter, and you've been given that vaccine that year, and you had an immune response to it, yes, it can protect you that year, okay? But the story doesn't end there, and that's really the problem, is oversimplification is a disease of the pro-vaccine. And so what happens after you're vaccinated, and there are studies, Hayward and Bodewies, I think these both came out in 2013 or 2014, which explains in great detail with really good studies that if you're vaccinated with an injected trivalent influenza vaccine, what that will do is it will stir up the immune system to create massive amounts of antibody towards those particular strains. Great, right? Well, what happens is that, you know, the antibody arm of the immunity and the cell-mediated arm of immunity usually work in synergy, and they work together. And it's not like either one of them is bad, but what happens after a vaccine is the antibody arm gets really ramped up. Well, that actually feeds back into the cellular arm and the memory arm, so that those antibodies that are created actually paralyze the immune system from creating memory immunity and cell-mediated immunity. And that's just a well-known documented fact. So that's really one of the problems when you don't want to talk about efficacy. It's very well known that if you've got get a flu shot 1 year, while it might help you if you're one of those few people that does, mm-hmm. I think you have to vaccinate like, you know, 100 people to, you know, prevent the flu and a handful. If you're one of those people, the following year, you're likely to be more susceptible to a pandemic if it comes through. And again, that's been shown in reality, in populations, and it's been shown experimentally.
So there's a difference between antibody immunity, that's humoral immunity, right? And then cellular immunity, which the cells have memory. So if you're exposed to, let's say Dr. Larry in this interview that we just did earlier today, he said, you know, you're exposed, there's a lot of research out now saying that if you're exposed to measles virus when you're young, that it protects you against many types of cancer when you're older. That's cellular immunity that you remember. But what you're saying is that these vaccines create humoral immunity, antibody immunity, right, which only lasts a short period of time and then it's gone.
Okay, so, you know, another problem that I see out when people talk about vaccines is that it's very convenient to paint all vaccines with the same brush, and we can't do that because the fact of the matter is there are different kinds of vaccines. Some of them have live viruses, some of them have killed viruses, some of them have killed bacteria, some have pieces of bacteria, pieces of virus. And so we have to distinguish, are we talking about a live virus? So when Dr. Pilevsky talks about the measles virus, he's talking about a live virus vaccine. And that vaccine, as well as other live viral vaccines, are known to stimulate the Th1 arm of immunity, which is your cell-mediated arm, and which does have a longer lasting, you really only need one or two shots to have long-term, perhaps 20 or 30 years of immunity, if you're one of the, you know, 90% of people who do respond to the vaccine, but between 2 and 10% never respond at all, which is something that is not very talked about very much. So live viral vaccines, that's true. Now, all the other vaccines we've talked about thus far today, the influenza vaccine, we talked about pertussis, whooping cough, but we didn't talk about the vaccine, but that's another killed vaccine, a subunit vaccine, and it has particles of the either some of the toxins or some of the pieces of the external bacteria. And so those vaccines don't stimulate immunity on their own. You have to add aluminum to them. Whereas influenza vaccine, you don't have to add aluminum to the influenza vaccine, but most of the other killed vaccines, you do need to add aluminum. And when you do that, what happens is you're stimulating that more of an antibody response than a cell-mediated response. And so those are the people that are going to be more prone to allergies later, and who won't have, that's why you need, you know, when you're a newborn baby at 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, you know, in 1 year, and then again when you're 4 years old, and now we're told that every time a woman is pregnant, she needs to get a pertussis vaccine. Well, that's why, because immunity is really short-lived after those particular vaccines. And the same is true for influenza. We need, even if it's the same strain that's circulating, so just say by chance that when they went to Asia to discover magically which three strains were circulating, if it was the same 2 years in a row, they wouldn't say, oh, no worries, you know, you got vaccinated last year for that. You don't need a vaccine. Have you ever heard that? No. And, you know, if there was even overlap, they wouldn't necessarily have to add that one strain in there for people who have already been vaccinated. But because it's such a short-lived immunity, if you can even call that immunity at all, there's been a lot of criticism from very conventional people on the influenza vaccines.
So then if the live virus vaccines can give you longer or cellular immunity, why don't they make them all live virus?
Well, they would. The thing about a viral vaccine is that you can, what they call attenuate it, which is basically when you hear the term passaging, it means that they take a virus, they basically get it out of the blood or the stool or the pus or the lungs of a person that's infected, and they either put it into another animal and then collect it somehow out of them again, or they put it through cell colonies in petri dishes. And in that process, they're able to pluck out the viruses that, say, die at lower temperatures or are just more fragile. And so those are the ones that you want to inject into somebody if you're going to inject a live virus. So they've been able to do that, and even in some cases they're working on inhaling some of those. For they want to be able to give newborn babies inhaled measles vaccines. But when it comes to others, like say HPV, they haven't been able to adequately attenuate that virus so that they can safely inject it live. And when it comes to bacteria, like they did used to have a whole cell pertussis vaccine, and it was more effective, but it was also more reactogenic. There were a lot more problems. I'm sure that Barbara Lowe Fisher talked about that because her kids were vaccinated during that period, and she wrote a book called A Shot in the Dark. And so there were a lot of people that had a lot of problems with that vaccine back then, and so that's why we have the new vaccine, which is less effective, but also less reactogenic. But it's still, there are still problems with this vaccine.
Right.
So it just depends on what they've been able to do in the lab is really the answer to your question.
Got it. Do our genes necessarily control our destiny?
Absolutely not. And, you know, this was what was taught to us in medical school 30 years ago. Was called the central dogma, that's basically it. You know, we're born with this set of genes, and if you've got a flaw in one of them, well, you might be okay now. In 10 years, maybe you won't be. It's about 1% of all diseases that this is actually true for. So what does that mean about all the rest of the diseases that we see every day? It's not because it's genetic. They've been trying to find a gene for autism, and they haven't. And for lots of diseases, it's not genetic. And I think one of the people that talks about this the most easy to understand and humorously is Bruce Lipton. And he talks about epigenetics and really breaks it down into a way where you can see, you know, visually. He's got really great visuals. And so I'm just going to give you a synopsis, which is that, you know, I think of genes as basically an incredible library inside of every one of your cells has this incredible library, and all the books are closed and folded upon each other. But they're in there, and when one of them needs to be active, they're awakened and they're used. And what tells your cells what needs to be awakened and active is what's happening on the outside of the cell, the skin of the cell, the surface of the cell, and also what's happening on the outside of your body and what you're breathing into your lungs and what your, you know, your thoughts are and your panic level. It's gonna change which genes get opened up and read and which proteins are produced. Now, there's huge amounts of medical material that demonstrates different stimulants that can open certain genes, and that's what epigenetics is. It basically means that something can happen that doesn't actually have to do with the amino acid sequence of your genes. It has to do with which of those books or genes was unraveled, unscrolled, opened up, read, and used for protein synthesis. So we know that certain foods that we eat can change. If you have clones of mice that are exactly the same genetically, you feed them different things, they develop different diseases, they turn different colors. Well, we're the exact same as them. Mm. You know, I have friends who are identical twins, and their mother says to me, I couldn't tell them apart when they were young. They were so identical. Nobody, you know, with twins, you can always tell. She said, nobody could tell these two apart. Well, they both have a congenital, a genetic disease, actually. And it supposedly doesn't manifest in females so much as in males. It's called Alport's syndrome. And so their father died with it. And that's how I got to know them. What's interesting is that one of the twins got a kidney transplant because she had kidney failure, and the other twin is perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. And this is a genetically mediated disease. So what does that tell you? You know, one of them had their epigenetics changed for the worse, and one of them for the better, and mm-hmm. one of them has they both have the gene, but they're not both manifesting the disease. Mm-hmm. And guess what the medical system keeps telling to the healthy one? It's going to happen to you someday. Well, she's now almost 50 years old. Mm-hmm. It hasn't happened.
Wow. Is it possible that vaccines are the equivalent of epigenetic tinkering with our DNA?
I think without a doubt. I mean, to me, a vaccine is an insult to your equilibrium, to your, you know, immune stability, and especially vaccines that contain aluminum. And I think that aluminum is an element that has been very well proven in the medical literature to have over 200 negative biological effects. It's a hormone interrupter. It interrupts how DNA is transcribed. It interrupts enzyme function, and so it has to. There's no way around it. And I've actually talked about this in depth. I did a talk called Trojan Horses and Cluster Bombs that's on YouTube, where I get into this in detail about how, you know, the epigenetic effects of vaccines and aluminum in particular, not just epigenetically, but, you know, all of the proof and evidence that aluminum is a neurotoxin and it's a biological toxin in lots of proven ways. But I absolutely can't see how it can, so we know that that your emotions and so stress can change your epigenetic profile. Well, a vaccine is a stress of grand proportions, and that's actually been shown by an author in the 1960s named Del Campo, who actually vaccinated something like 500 children and measured with intricacy their EKGs, their acid buildup in their blood, measured all kinds of parameters, and said that, you know, it is a very stressful event. So if we know that emotions can change you epigenetically, of course, you know, a stressful intramuscular injection that contains aluminum and biological agents is going to change you epigenetically.
Mm. It's kind of a double whammy, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not only do you have the emotional stress of just the pain, but then you've got all of the toxins inside of the vaccine as well that can have epigenetic triggers as well.
Well, yes, that. And I've actually shown at least three different studies, one by Ladenpara, one by Orntoft, and one by Hamza, which show exactly the genes that are upregulated after different vaccinations. One was hepatitis B vaccine, one was pertussis toxin, and the other was the DTP vaccine. Mm. And so it's just well shown that all kinds of disease genes, which are, these are genes that are, you know, are upregulated at the wrong time in your life, which actually makes a disease. So say, you know, when we're young, we're supposed to be growing. So those genes are open while we're young, don't cause cancer. But when we're young, they're not supposed to be active. When we're older, they're not supposed to be active. So then they can be cancer upregulated in situations of cancer. So these scientists have shown without any doubt at all that epigenetics are altered by vaccination, and they're altered for the worse. There were none of them that were for the better after vaccination.
Hmm. Have you heard about the different cases over the last couple of decades where tetanus toxoid was actually laced with HCG, causing spontaneous abortion and so forth?
Well, I have all those papers, and what really surprised me the most is that research was not done covertly. It was very put out in the open. This one Indian researcher was talking about how, you know, we needed better birth control in these highly overpopulated, that's what they consider them, overpopulated areas, and that it was supposed to be a temporary effect, and according to them it is. And so basically it has HCG, so the mother mounts an antibody response, so she's not going to, you know, be able to be pregnant because that hormone's necessary. And but they were giving, you know, these vaccines far more frequently than they needed to prevent tetanus.
Mm-hmm.
And so this, it's not actually covert research. It was very much out in the open. I have all the papers. And you know, for people to have gotten to a point where they felt that that was okay, I think that's really what surprised me the most, that this was considered an ethical thing. And they actually considered it to be, you know, a gift to these populations, that they wanted to help them control their numbers.
Mm. I don't think the populations looked at it as a gift.
No, I don't think they were. I mean, one thing if some mother said, yeah, you know, I'll take that one because, you know, we don't have any other form of birth control, but they weren't even told. And then it was denied later that that's actually what they were doing. However, I believe that a group of people had some samples and they checked these vaccines and found the HCG in it. And there is all this literature showing the development of it.
I mean, isn't that in violation of several different agreements that we've signed, like the Geneva Convention, the Nuremberg Codes, the things that prohibit us from experimenting on our citizens?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, isn't that medical experimentation?
Well, I believe that they would see whenever I think about something, I always think about the other side would say back to me.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were to use that argument, I think they would say no, because we did the experiments in the lab and we found that it was safe and it was effective and it accomplished the goal that we wanted to accomplish. So no, it wasn't experimental. It was untruthful, but it wasn't necessarily experimental in their view.
So they knew the outcome. So it was just, they just
exactly.
did it covertly.
Yes, yes.
Okay. All right. Remind me to get them on my team if I ever need to go in court.
Hope that day never comes.
Yeah. Can you talk about your book, Rising from the Dead? You gave me a copy a couple of days ago. Unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to read all 500 and something pages of it yet.
But
maybe that was dissolving delusions.
Yeah, dissolving illusions was 500. Over 500
pages.
Yeah. Well, Rising from the Dead is pretty much my autobiography, starting from the end of high school to today. And I really wrote the book mostly for parents. And I wanted them to see a couple of things. One is what it's really like. And I went into great detail about what pretty much every medical student goes through, about how, you know, most of us start out wanting to be helpful, you know, wanting to, you know, thinking that we are going to learn things that are going to be curing diseases and really helping people. And then we're very excited when we start medical school. You know, it's a very exciting time and it's very challenging. And then if you fail, it's horrible because then you have to leave. But those of us that survive and make it to the end, it's a monumental event. And then we're basically worn down, you know, like water on a rock over and over and over, with just, you know, the lack of sleep and the amount of knowledge that we have to gain in a short period of time and the stresses of having to deal with people with all kinds of horrible conditions and pain. And, you know, by the end of it, we come out the other end, oftentimes very disillusioned, depressed. A lot of medical doctors become addicted to alcohol and drugs. The suicide rate is very high. And so why is that? Well, it's because we didn't learn to be healers in medical school. We learned to be technicians that manage disease in medical school. And if you do happen to figure out a way that heals, and it's not within the, you know, confines or the gold standards of what you were taught, then you're told it's quackery and that you're going to endanger yourself and your patient if you try it. And so what happens is you get two different, you know, I think, streams of doctors. You get some that just ride the money wave and think they're on top of the world and everything's great, and then what they learned is the best medicine possible and they're happy and fine and they're not doing really good for their patients necessarily. Although if you're a surgeon, I want to back up and say, and I always make this very clear, that I believe there is a place for conventional medicine. I've experienced the benefit of conventional medicine. Most of us have. If you've been in an accident, if you have organ failure, if you have a kidney stone that won't pass, things like that, conventional medical doctors, if they're, you know, doing a good job, they're a godsend, okay? But most of the conditions that doctors treat on an everyday basis is not that. So it's very depressing to see, you know, say a healthy baby come in and then you give several vaccines in one day and then, you know, the snotty noses start, the ear infections, the ear tubes. And I remember doing my pediatrics rotation thinking, wow, kids are so sick. I wonder, like, how we all survived. Like, I really just, this just went through me, like, how have we survived as humanity since we've only had these antibiotics around for so long? And I just couldn't put the pieces together back then. And so, you know, the same thing happened in adult medicine where I just thought, well, this, nobody's getting better. If some of you have high blood pressure, I'm sticking you on at least one blood pressure drug for the rest of your life and mostly telling you I don't know how to cure it, because the numbers of cases of high blood pressure that can be cured because they're secondary causes are very small. Most of them they call essential hypertension, and you're relegated to several drugs throughout your lifetime, and then you end up with another disease as a result, and another disease, because the real reason for your high blood pressure was never addressed. This is very depressing. And so these doctors that go through that phase, I call the walking dead. They don't know they're dead. They don't know that there's anything better going on the outside. You know, they just go through the motions, and what they had hoped for in the beginning did not come true. And I fell into that category. And so it's, you know, the book details a lot of my encounters in the medical system when I noticed the problem and tried to bring it to attention and what the results were. So it's a lot of stories of my awakening to the point where the whole vaccine thing happened. And then after that, what was really interesting is that, you know, once I realized the problem with vaccines, and like the first thing that you would, you know, naturally ask is, well, who would be doing this and why and how did this happen? And then you start to realize that all of medicine is tainted that way. It's really not just the area of vaccines. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's one of the reasons why vaccinology is protected the way it is, because if more doctors were to figure out just how deep and long the problem has been, that they would start questioning a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I look forward to reading the book. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to get all 400 and whatever pages in the last 2 days, but it does look really interesting.
Okay.
So, Dr. Suzanne, let's say that we, a few years down the road, are in a situation in the United States that we have forced vaccines in every state. And God forbid we get to that point, but you have to go in and you have to get caught up on vaccines in order to get a kidney transplant or whatever it might be. Is there anything that you can do to help mitigate the damage that could be done by those vaccines?
Okay, well, I'm going to first say that I'm really reluctant to answer that question because I'm working as hard as I can that that day never comes, and that I don't believe there is a way that you can remove the damage or the potential damage that happens with vaccines. And there are situations today which are similar to that, even though the laws haven't changed. And one of the calls I get very frequently is, my child has kidney failure and they need a kidney transplant, and the doctors are making them get all the vaccines, even though, you know, I wouldn't otherwise give them. Is there anything you can do? And the answer is, none of those doctors have been willing to listen to me, despite the fact that there is evidence that that you develop antibodies to when you're vaccinated that can actually cause organ rejection later. And that the cases that I've known of that were unvaccinated and got kidney transplants are the ones that do the best in the long run. So those doctors won't listen to me. When it comes to military people, I think those are some of the people today that can't get out of their vaccines, although I have gotten some ranking officials out of their vaccines by writing letters for them, and their superiors accepted it. I think that a person needs to be very well hydrated. Now, if you're breastfeeding, breast milk actually does make vaccine outcomes better. It's not a guarantee, but breastfeeding, 100% breastfeeding is better than 50% breastfeeding. If you're no longer breastfeeding because you're full grown, then your nutrition should be optimized. You should be well hydrated, and your antioxidant stores should be as high as possible beforehand and afterwards. I think that chiropractic adjustments could possibly be helpful before and after. I think that possibly some, heavy metal binders like certain kinds of mineral water that can bind to aluminum could be drank before and after. And that it's been shown by, I believe it was Dr. Chris Exley, that showed that if drinking certain types of mineral water can eliminate that aluminum. Sweating also eliminates a lot of aluminum. The real problem, why I can't say, here's what you can do to protect, is that, you know, there are things in vaccines called adventitious agents. These are the SV40s of the old days. Well, we still have them today. We have, you know, viruses that shouldn't be in there that they find later after the vaccines are mass marketed. And the only, you know, defense against that is a really strong immune system. And so you have to just do the general things that you would normally do to keep your immune system as strong as possible. So if you're sick, you shouldn't get a vaccine. If you've got any sort of sickness, I don't believe that a vaccine can benefit you in that time, because it takes time for a vaccine to become effective. And oftentimes it takes more than one vaccine for you to become fully what they would call protected. Mm-hmm. So there's no reason, in my opinion, to give a sick person a vaccine ever, ever, ever. So I think it's just more, you know, vitamin C, keeping your microbiome straightened out, you know, making sure that you've been eating fermented foods and, you know, keeping your intestines healthy, because 70% or more of your immune system is located in there. So, you know, anyone I talk to or treat as a patient, there's two things that I ask them to do right off the bat, and that is to start eating fermented food and start using vitamin C if they're sick. And so those are two things that I think you can never go wrong with, no matter what. And then there's all kinds of detoxification. There are people that do this for a living. Like, I'm more into prevention. I don't treat vaccine injuries or do detox, but there are certainly a myriad of different approaches that can be taken to detoxify.
Okay, good. Well, thank you for your time, Dr. Suzanne. I share your optimism. I actually think that we're making headway, and I'm not thinking that a few years down the road that will be the case. I pray it isn't, but I think we are making inroads, and I think there's enough momentum now and enough people that are waking up where that won't take place here in the United States. So we'll keep up the good work. You keep up the good work, and we'll keep that from happening.
Okay.